This podcast was recorded Thursday, June 20th at 10:31 a.m. Things may have changed by the time you hear this. Like, now that summer has arrived, it will cool off. It was a hot end to spring. Let's talk politics. This is Snollygoster, WOSU Public Media's weekly look at Ohio politics and all those Snollygosters, those shrewd politicians who never forget a face or a favor until it's inconvenient to remember them. I'm Mike Thompson. Coming up in the podcast, another puff of smoke puts Governor DeWine closer to the House Bill 6 fire. But first, remember this from 2020?
Vote now.
Are you going to pack the
Make
court?
Sure you, in fact, let people know you're a senator. I'm not going to answer the question.
Why
because,
would you answer that
because
question?
Because the
you
question
put a
is,
lot of
the
new
question
Supreme
is,
Court justice, radical left.
Will you
who
shut
is
up,
your,
man?
Listen, who is on your list, Joe?
This
Who's
is
on
so
your
right.
list?
Gentlemen,
this is,
I think
this
we've
is
ended
so
this.
Unprecedented.
He's going to pack the court.
One of the most memorable quotes of that campaign, Joe Biden telling the President of the United States to shut up, man. Well, next week, the same two men will meet again on the debate stage. CNN will host the first of two scheduled debates at its studios in Atlanta. It will be one of the most closely watched political events in history. Voters likely will learn nothing new about the two men's policies, but we will see if the two men are up for the job for the next 4 years. Of course, we'll be watching Joe Biden to see how his 81 years on the planet are catching up to him. And we'll be watching Donald Trump, who's only 3 years younger, to see if his criminal convictions and indictments are catching up to him. Now, in the days leading up to the debate, the campaigns and candidates are preparing, fine-tuning their messages, and trying to anticipate questions from the moderators and trying to anticipate attacks by their competitor. Our guest this week has been very involved in similar preparations for top elected officials here in Ohio. Republican strategist Terry Casey has advised former Governor John Kasich, U.S. Senate candidate Josh Mandel, and current Governor Mike DeWine as they prepared for their one-on-one debates. In fact, Terry played the role of Democrats Ted Strickland, Sherrod Brown, and Richard Cordray in the practice debates leading up to the real debates. And Terry, we welcome you back to Snollygoster.
Glad to be here.
I think it's safe to say in your mock debate, you never told Governors Kasich or DeWine to shut up.
Didn't quite do that, but did a lot of other things that didn't always make them happy and kind of were irritating. But that's the purpose and the reason why you do these debate preps. One reason is timing, because example with Mike DeWine, he had been attorney general for 8 years. And he's used to speaking to groups in 5, 7, 12, 15 minutes. But when you get used to, like in that debate, only having 90 seconds or 60 seconds, it's a different timing thing.
So, well, Mike DeWine still likes to talk for 5, 12, 15 minutes, but that's okay. We'll get to the actual debate prep.
He knew he had to be shorter and crisper.
Yeah, we'll get to the actual practice debates in a moment. But so just bigger picture, what is debate prep like? What do campaigns and candidates, what do they do in the weeks and days leading up to a debate?
Well, there's two parts to it. One, they'll do some short little, you might call it softball kind of things, of a wide variety of different questions just to kind of get used to and be prepared and be thinking about what you're going to respond, because sometimes the media likes to throw out tangential questions that people weren't expecting. So part of it's the softball, just getting used to the huge wide range of issues that could come up. And whether you're president or governor, it is quite a range. But the biggest thing is getting used to the timing. And I think in this debate next week, each candidate's going to have 120 seconds, which is a lot more time than 60 seconds or 90 seconds. But still, how do you use that time? Because in some cases, you might want to clean up something your opponent said or you said earlier in the debate. In some cases, you want to answer the basic question, but then take your remaining time to spin or do some kind of attack or difference in that time period. So how you use short time segments is very important. And again, getting used to, instead of doing a speech for 10 or 15 minutes, doing it in 30 seconds or 60 seconds is the challenge.
Do candidates in the campaigns, they have clear strategies going in to a debate? Do they really want to hammer on one or two issues? Is there a strategy to make the other person look bad? Obviously, you want to ease concerns about leadership and qualifications for the job. That's one of the things the debate tries to do, right?
Well, the first rule is no gaffes or goofs, because if you say something stupid, and we've had a lot of history of that, probably the best was in 1988, Dukakis from your state of Massachusetts versus George H.W. Bush, when he was asked the question about if his wife was raped and murdered, would he go for the death penalty? And he kind of muffed that because he gave the typical question, he's opposed to the death penalty. It made it seem like he was uncaring about his wife.
Do you think he was overprepared for that question, Terry?
Well, that's one in the first Reagan debate, I think, versus Carter. The feeling was they tried to stuff too many factoids into Reagan's brain, and he came off kind of wooden and just didn't connect very well with the audience. Then, as I recall, the second debate, he did much better, including his famous line, "There you go again."
Yeah.
So
and also the great line he had against Walter Mondale, talking about, again, age issue. There were questions about Reagan's age, and he said he's not going to hold his competitor's youth and inexperience against him, which was a pre-planned line, but it was a great one.
Absolutely, because people forget this is partly about substance, but it's also about style. And as Bob Schieffer, the CBS guy, summarized, when people are watching on TV, a lot of people want to know, am I comfortable with this person? Would I invite him into my home? And most importantly, if there's a crisis on something never asked, how well would they handle it? What's their mood? What's their approach to handling things?
Let's get to the questions. How long a list of questions do campaigns come up with trying to guess what the moderators, if they're the ones asking the questions, will have, or if there's a panel of reporters, or even if there's a town hall, what the voters might ask?
It's a long, long list. And when you're running for governor or president, it's so wide ranging of, you know, like president, it's not just national, but international. And then all the variations. And then again, the media folks, they like to impress the audience. Well, what a good question I've asked. So they have a lot of twists and turns in their questions, trying to do gotcha movements. I mean, that's just part of the media versus candidate battle and balance.
Now, speaking as a person who has moderated quite a few debates, gotcha is a relative term. When I script questions, I am trying to script a question that makes the candidate answer it with a clear yes or a no, or makes it obvious to the viewer or the listener that the candidate is avoiding the question. So that's always my thinking when I'm trying to form a question for a candidate, like, will you support higher taxes? I want the candidate to say yes or no or avoid it, so the audience knows that person is avoiding it.
Well, you do a very good job in debates of trying to get to the substance and the meat of things. But one of the key tactics by people on both sides is the magic double D's of deflecting and dodging.
Yes, indeed.
That's why when a candidate will sometimes hear the question, they'll say, that's a very good question, because a lot of people are concerned about that. What they're doing is they're trying to think in their brain, gosh, I hadn't anticipated that. What am I going to say? So by saying that's a very good question, blah, 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 it's a way to deflect and dodge. And again, try and half answer it or not answer it, and then move to something else they're more comfortable talking about.
My takeaway is whenever a person you're interviewing says, you know, I really appreciate that question, they really don't. They didn't like that question, but that's okay.
Absolutely. It's all part of the dodge and deflect.
Well, even that first clip that we played of Trump and Biden sparring and Biden telling Trump to shut up, Biden didn't answer the question. Chris Wallace asked him, will you pack the court? And he did not answer the question. It gets lost in the whole, the highlight was when he told him to shut up, but what gets lost is that Biden didn't answer the question.
Absolutely. And dodging questions is a key part of it, because there's some things you just don't want to get pinned down on.
Talking about that timing, you only have 90 seconds, or in this debate, they'll have up to 2 minutes. I think the rebuttals are a minute. How much are the answers scripted by the communications staff?
Well, there's a balance because you can talk about lines, or during the practice debates, the candidate might say something that needs to be fine-tuned or needs to be avoided. So that's part of the reason of doing practice debates under real circumstances, so you get used to the give and take and how to answer.
Yeah.
But again, the candidate's interrupting, and obviously the sample you gave is an example where it got out of control. But dodging questions is one of the key things, because people forget that on Donald Trump, when he did his first debate in the summer in Cleveland, the Republican primary debate, a lot of people were surprised by how well he did, because he obviously was not a practiced politician. He was not a trained lawyer used to litigation in a courtroom, et cetera. But people forgot way back early in his career, he did a lot of zoning meetings where he was used to hearing people attack, be angry, be bitter, and all that. So he was used to taking attacks, but not looking like it's bothering you. And then as he listened to all the different attack points, he figured out the weakest one. And then in the response, he'd go back and look at the weakest link in the chain and attack that, and forget and ignore the ones that were more substantive, that were harder to answer.
Yeah, never. That's another question. That's another rule that reporters often break, is never ask more than one question. Ask one question at a time, because if you ask two questions, the politician gets to pick the one that he or she likes best. So one-part questions, please.
Absolutely.
You also want to try to avoid certain phrases, right? In the prep, you don't want to say, you know, something that could be taken out of context at some point, something that could be used in a political ad.
You can try and avoid that, but people, and I've gone through some debate preps. One of them I can think of is in 2006 for State Auditor Mary Taylor. They said, no taping, or we didn't want to rely on the cable thing that was taping it. So we had our own camera person there. And fortunately, we got some nice little sound bites that were used in TV commercials. Uh-huh. So people do look at ways to use those things if you aren't careful in what the heck you say.
Now, let's get to your role of playing the opponent. What did you do to prepare? Say you're the most recent one, Richard Cordray. You played Richard Cordray. So what did you do to play the role of Richard Cordray?
Well, part of it is you want to be prepared in things he said in the past so that you can accurately reflect to the candidate what's going to be said on different issues, what are the talking points that the other person will do. But then you also prepare on attacking on certain things, certain weaknesses of the candidate, because example in the Cordray versus DeWine, the first debate was in Dayton. And Richard Cordray is regarded as more of a little more intellectual, mm-hmm. a little lower key kind of person. But in that debate, he actually was very aggressive. But in the debate prep, I played the more aggressive side because you needed to get the candidate used to. Because again, speaking to local Rotary clubs or Republican functions, you can kind of talk on and on and on. But you've got to be prepared. The candidate's got to be prepared to take hits and be prepared for the opponent to put digs in. And how do you respond? Because again, the normal human thing is when you're attacked, you take it personally, and then you want to punch back, and that isn't always the smartest strategy.
Yeah.
How do you take hits? How do you respond? What's your counterpoint?
Yeah, I mean, it's like anything else, and this is practice. And the better your performance in your event, whether it's sports or it's politics, the harder the practice, the better you'll perform in the actual event. So how hard did you go after these guys? I'm thinking, John Kasich, he was kind of a prickly guy. And when you're playing Ted Strickland, did you ever make him angry so much?
I think so. But he was, again, one of the advantages John Kasich had had. He had had years of being in Congress, yeah. and then he also had years of being on Fox TV and that kind of thing. So he was used to a little more of the give and take and the short little sound bites of things. But there were a number of things that got him irritated. And it reminds me, in one of the debates with John Kasich in the practice sessions, the pollster from Virginia was in town and he had his 10-year-old daughter there and she was watching the whole thing. And at the end of it, she said, "Why was the governor so mean to Mr. Kasich?" And she didn't understand that I wasn't Governor Strickland. I was playing the role. Uh-huh. But she was so surprised that the governor was attacking John Kasich so much. But again, you've got to do that because candidates got to get used to it isn't softball in a small town in Ohio from a local radio station asking you a vague question where you can go on and on. It's a different style of attack and timing.
Anything that you did in the mock debates actually happen almost word for word or very close to word for word in the actual debate?
I don't think it's word for word, but it's just the whole thing of getting used to taking punches and how do you respond. And then another thing that will happen is after you do the session, and usually these are videotaped, you have different people asking different questions and the moderator, that type of thing. So it replicates the real thing in terms of timing and being used to how to pace yourself. But then you'll go back and critique. You should have said this. You forgot to mention that. You went off on this that gets you in trouble, et cetera, et cetera. So it's again, just like in the football game at Ohio Stadium might be on Saturday, but the practice sessions on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday are very important to get you used to and prepared, and also to know some of the attack points that'll be coming from the other side.
Yeah, and you got to watch the film. You got to watch the film. It's as uncomfortable as it can be, I'm sure, but that's what the viewer sees, is what's on that film.
Right.
Looking ahead to next week's debate, you know, we, like I said at the beginning, we know these two candidates backwards and forwards, I think. There's very little we don't know about where they stand on certain things. There's some, you know, tweaks around the edges on things like immigration and things like that. So this is really going to be, how do these two men do on this stage, particularly Joe Biden, but also Donald Trump coming off his recent conviction? What are you watching for?
Well, part of it is both candidates are very, very rusty because neither of them had any primary debates. And it's been a long time, 4 years ago, and those were different. So the rustiness, because Donald Trump is used to doing a rally where he speaks for an hour, hour and a half continuous, does certain versions of his humor, et cetera, et cetera. And Biden's been used to reading off the teleprompters, what the staff has written up for him. So this is a very different environment for both candidates. But again, they're both rusty. And sometimes the first debate isn't always the best. And so that's why the second one will be really important. How do they change? What do they do? And the conclusion from the last presidential debate was the first one. Everyone agreed, including on the Republican side, that Trump was too hot.
Yeah.
And in media terms, when you're too hot, because people are watched in their living room and they want some degree of contrast, but they don't want things to get too bloody as they're watching in their comfortable living room or family room.
Rules are a little different. They're going to cut the mics. The mics will only be hot. They'll only be turned on during that candidate's allotted time. So the talking over is going to be not eliminated, but it'll be off mic if it happens.
Hopefully that'll be the case, but sometimes the microphones pick up the larger comments. We'll just kind of see how it goes. But I'm sure that there's some people around Trump cautioning him in terms of how he does it, how he plays it. But again, 2 minutes is on each person is a lot of time. So again, the mix is how much of those 120 seconds do you take answering the question or deflecting on the question, and how much do you then flip and switch gears to go on the attack? Because there's nothing the moderator can do if you're only going to take 15 seconds to answer or deflect on the question and then spend the rest of the time going after another subject where you feel the opponent's weaker.
Yeah, and that's where the ability to ask follow-ups helps. I think they do have the ability to ask follow-ups. I mean, the way it's 2 minutes to start, then I think the rebuttals are 1 minute until the moderator feels that that topic or that question has been exhausted. So there's some leeway, but you're right. There's not a whole lot of leeway on if candidates want to totally duck a question.
Right. And the moderators in the past, there's been some key questions. Candy Crowley in 2012 comes up where she spent a lot of time or a certain amount of time correcting and then later admitting she didn't quite do it accurately when Romney said a certain kind of thing. So, and I know I've seen some other debates in Ohio where the moderator appoints herself as the fact checker, and to the audience, it can come off like the moderator's being unfair and create sympathy for the candidate being put under that scrutiny. Again, you haven't had that disease.
And I've made that mistake in a couple of debates. And what you learn from that is that's not your role. You let the journalist on the side fact check it later, unless it's something really egregious.
Absolutely. But the moderator role is you hopefully want people to forget about the moderator and just think about the candidates. But if the moderator becomes part of the controversy, then that's not the ideal circumstance.
My rule is don't fact check really on the fly, but try to get them to answer the question. That's kind of what I try to make sure that at very least, if they don't want to answer the question, the audience knows they're not answering the question. What's Biden's key strategy? What's the key thing he wants to accomplish, Terry?
Well, I think he wants to paint Trump as radical and extreme and is going to take the world into war and the economy will go to hell and everything like that. And I think one of the key differences in 2020 versus 24, in 20, Trump was on the defensive because of COVID. And we were right in the middle of COVID. The vaccine was getting close, but it wasn't there. And there was a lot of uncertainty. So again, Trump then was on the defensive. Now Biden's going to be on the defensive because he's got to defend certain things with the economy and inflation and immigration. But also we've got this huge wild card of where in the world are we headed in terms of the Middle East, Taiwan, Russia, North Korea, Iran. The world's not as safe today as it seemingly was in the past.
Yeah. What's Trump's key strategy? What's he looking to do?
I think he wants to go after the Biden record on economy, because when Biden tries to say we've got the best economy in the world and our inflation is less than parts of Europe and other parts of the world, the problem is most people and the 335 million people in America, they don't live and operate in all these other countries. They're going to the grocery store. They're going to the gas pump. So Biden's going to want to try and point to bipartisan things, but Trump's going to attack on certain waste and other things in many of these bills.
How aggressively does Trump go after Biden's age? Do you think he just lets the camera decide for themselves, let the viewer decide for themselves, or does he go after him?
The problem on age is he's not a spring chicken.
No,
either,
he's not.
Even though he's
3.5 years younger.
Yeah, he's got more energy. I mean, most people, as they look at him, I mean, to get up on a stage at a rally, you can debate what he says and what you like and don't like, but to get up on a stage for an hour and a half, to go on and keep the crowd interested and entertained, he's definitely got more stamina, more energy. And again, the mobility of Biden, as we've seen in the various clips, is something under debate. So we'll see how he does. And I forget when the final rules, whether the candidates are going to be seated or standing.
They are standing, but there are two commercial breaks, which gives them a break to get some coaching and also give them a break just.
Well, you know, but supposedly under the rules, they're not allowed to talk to their staff and get coaching.
All right.
But maybe
they have hand signals like in baseball, you know, like maybe they can have like that guy from Michigan, the assistant coach or the grad student, he could be doing hand signals to both of the candidates to help him out. Anyway,
who knows? It'll be. And again, this is television, and going back, I'm old enough. You're too young, Mike, to remember 1960 Kennedy versus
not even on the planet yet, Terry.
Nixon. But that was one that reinforced its television. Yeah. And what people see with their own eyes tends to be very compelling. So again, you've got a balance, because you don't want to be too hot. You don't want to be too stiff. How do you come across in your body language?
It will be must-see TV one way or the other. And it'll be really interesting. It'll be good. I think good for the process. Hopefully it's a good debate. Terry Casey, Republican strategist. Thanks for joining us here on Snollygoster.
Enjoyed it. Thank you.
We'll be right back.
I'm Rachel Martin. You probably know how interview podcasts with famous people usually go. There's a host, a guest, and a light Q&A. But on Wildcard, we have ripped up the typical script. It's a new podcast from NPR where I invite actors, artists, and comedians to play a game using a special deck of cards to talk about some of life's biggest questions. Listen to Wildcard wherever you get your podcasts, only from NPR.
Welcome back to Snollygoster. In the House Bill 6 nuclear bailout scandal, Governor Mike DeWine has never been charged with a crime or even seriously implicated in any wrongdoing. But the connection between the governor and the scandal is clear. He had close ties to First Energy, the utility company at the heart of the case, and he appointed the chair of the state's Public Utilities Commission, who was charged with accepting bribes, and then he died by suicide this spring. Every couple of months or so, another drip of evidence of DeWine's ties to the case leaks out. This week's little drip was first reported by Cleveland.com. DeWine, in 2018, texted First Energy CEO Chuck Jones in the final days of his first campaign for governor, that campaign against Richard Cordray. DeWine asked Jones to call him, and he noted that the Ohio Teachers Union was giving big bucks to Richard Cordray, the Democratic opponent. A few days later, First Energy gave $500,000 to a political action group that supported DeWine, and First Energy's lobbyist told Chuck Jones, the CEO, to let DeWine know about the donation. DeWine told reporters this week he did not recall that conversation, and he again strongly denied the donations affected his decision to support the nuclear plant bailouts.
I don't know how many times I have to say this to you or anybody else. I supported nuclear energy in the state of Ohio. My opponent in the gubernatorial race supported nuclear energy. I supported this bill because it supported nuclear energy and the current nuclear facilities that we have.
Again, no evidence of a crime or anything but a candidate in a tough race asking for money. But it's another bit of evidence of First Energy's influence at the highest reaches of state government. Time now for our Snollygoster of the Week segment, where we honor the shrewdest politician or political move of the past 7 days. This week, we go down south. We give it to lawmakers in Louisiana who now require the Ten Commandments be posted in every classroom, kindergarten through seniors in high school. But they didn't stop there. According to the rules, the poster must be big. It has to be at least 11 inches by 14 inches, which really isn't that big if you sit in the back of the class, but be that as it may. So it has to be 11 by 14, and it has to have easily readable font. I wonder what font that would be. Times New Roman? Arial? What font did Moses have in those tablets? What was the font there? They should replicate that. I bet that wasn't that easy to read. Anyway, for requiring the Ten Commandments in every classroom and to make sure the kids can read them, we give our Snollygoster of the Week award to lawmakers in Louisiana. That will do it for this week's edition of Snollygoster, which is part of the NPR network. As always, please be sure to give us a good review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. That really helps boost our audience here. And, of course, just tell your friends about us. For our student producer, Katie Genius, our digital producer, Michael DeBonis, and our audio engineer, Dalton Jones, I'm Mike Thompson for Snollygoster from WOSU Public Media.